history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories around you just waiting to be told. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, entertained. So often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation, like the story of Glenn Ferguson, a 96-year-old retired Marine Corps aviator who you got to hear a little bit from last time at the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum in San Diego. If you missed it, pull up episode number 521 at hometownheroesradio.com. Glenn's father had served in the Marines in World War I. In 1939, Glenn Jr. decided to follow in those Semper Fi footsteps, and we're going to pick things up in July 1942 when he received a unique assignment responsible for protecting a very important person.
They were setting up the retreat for Roosevelt called Shangri-La. It was a retreat up the Catoctin Mountains. It had been created by the CCC. There were three areas there. One area was taken over by the Secret Service to develop the house for the president. Then they put a big fence around that. It enclosed many acres. And then outside of that fence, about 10 foot outside of that fence, they put another fence, and it was the Marines' responsibility to patrol that inner perimeter, and you got shot if you got into that area. And one of the problems that we had was that a lot of the people that we were given for guards were out of the cities, didn't know how to live in the woods, and as a result, they killed off the black snakes before I found out about it. And it wasn't but a very short while later that we were overrun with copperheads, which are dangerous because they don't give you any warning and they're deadly. So anyhow, I got that stopped, but not soon enough. And then Roosevelt came up. He was upset because of all the guards that we had up there to protect him. We told him about the training we were giving. I was giving camouflage training and things like that. Anyhow, he asked a lot of questions, and he was satisfied and finally went back. At the same time that we had set that up, the department that was bringing people from Europe to train them over here and send them back to commit sabotage behind the lines.
OSS?
Yeah. It was OSS back in those days.
Yeah.
The OSS was training the people. Another sergeant and myself had set up the guards, and we had our own cabin that was built up on stilts. And these people would divide up into friend and enemy. For their graduation, they would have the enemy. The way I could tell that they were attacking was the sentry would hear something and challenge it. It'd be one of the officers. He would challenge in one language, answer in another language, and then talk in a third language. Anyhow, the whole idea was for the enemy to sneak in and attach a dynamite cap to the pilings that our cabin was built on. That's the only communication we had with them. They'd never tell us. But it was our friends, and so I never complained about it. It didn't happen that often. But that's the way I knew that we were being attacked that night.
And this is what we know now as Camp David?
Yeah. Eisenhower renamed it Camp David after his grandson. While all this was going on, they were building the east wing of the White House. And so then they pulled me down to become the receptionist for the east wing of the White House. I was given a desk and a phone, which was unusual for the east wing. And a lot of the important people like Madam Chiang Kai-shek, her brothers, the Sung brothers, and Madam Chiang Kai-shek would use the east wing.
I'm just listening to you, and I'm thinking about this 21-year-old kid, 22-year-old kid.
Yeah, that wanted to be overseas.
But you're around some of the most powerful people in the world. And you talked about Roosevelt giving you guys a hard time at Shangri-La, like, hey, that's just that guy over there. This is the President of the United States who you just heard on December 8th talking about the day that will live in infamy, and the whole country's listening to this guy.
Well, I can tell you a story about Roosevelt, too. The cross corridor, I was finally put out on quarters and rations and paid to rent a room. And it was only a couple of blocks from the White House. And so I would walk to work in the morning. And there was a delicatessen that I usually stopped at on the way to work. Got a carton of milk and a box of cookies. That was my breakfast. And so one morning I was a little late and I skipped it. And so I decided later on that morning that I'd go over to the West Wing to the mail room. They had a stand there with the bags of popcorn and candy and that sort of thing. So anyhow, I went over there and the Secret Service all knew me. So when I came back, they all said hi, good morning, that sort of thing, but didn't tell me the president was coming down. There was a big etching of Abraham Lincoln hanging on the side wall. I had never really looked at it carefully, so I decided to walk over close to it and look at it as I walked by. Well, it was right on the corner of a little anteroom where was the opening to the elevator from the second floor that they brought the president down in. He had polio, so he couldn't walk and was in a wheelchair and was pushed around. And so at the moment that I walked by that etching, the fellow pushed him out in a wheelchair. And I had one foot, I actually had one foot forward. How I ever stopped walking, I don't know. But I almost laid across his lap. That would have given me a good trip to Siberia. Yeah, I said, good morning, President. And he didn't seem to know that anything had been close. So anyhow, and another little episode was, like I said, I was tired of sitting behind a desk. You know, I wanted to be overseas. And so I built a model airplane. Why I didn't get fired, I don't know. But I built a model airplane and took it out to fly it and flew up on the roof.
The roof of the White House.
Yeah, so I climbed out Eleanor Roosevelt's, I went up the second floor and climbed out the window of her office up there to the roof and got my airplane. Mr. Krim, who was the head usher that I worked for, he never said anything about it. I don't know whether he ever knew or not.
These days you might get shot trying to pull that off.
Well, nobody ever said anything to me, but I got my airplane back.
Well, and you mentioned something, the story about almost landing in the president's lap. You saw it up close and personal. You knew what most of America didn't know, that he was confined to a wheelchair.
Oh, yeah, because the press was pretty good about showing him standing up. If you notice, when he stood up, he was always supported by somebody because he had braces that he had to lock. When he stood up and straightened out his legs, they would lock the braces, and then he would hang on to his sons or somebody, a cabinet member, in order to walk up to the podium and that sort of thing. If you notice, he never walked very far, just a few steps.
And as far as his personality or his significance as the president you had known for most of your life at that point, is there some light you can shed on him as a person that maybe people who didn't get as close to the action White House-wise as you did might not expect?
Well, I suppose in answer to your question is they built a big swimming pool there in the bottom floor of the White House, and they kept it very hot. It was always steamy because of his polio. So they did a lot of work with him there at the White House, but I didn't have any social action with him.
And I don't want to linger too long on this because I know we've got a lot more to go in your aviation career. But I'm just thinking about you again as this young kid at what we know now as Camp David, this presidential retreat, which is just in its infancy. But when you're out there, your job is to protect the President of the United States. Did that weigh on you? Was that a pressure job, high anxiety, or no big deal?
Once again, I'm a Marine. I do what I'm told. I don't think anything about it. I'll tell you a little incident, though, that kind of bothered us. We went on Liberty down to Hagerstown, Maryland, down the mountain. The lieutenant would appoint one of the men as an MP liaison. He had to be an MP rather than on a Liberty. One of the fellows that we got in our unit was an older man, but he was only a corporal. In other words, he hadn't been in too long. We had to be aboard the truck to leave at 10 o'clock. And he ordered everybody out of this restaurant we were all in, waiting for the truck. He ordered everybody out to get ready for the truck. The answer was, hey, the truck's not even here yet. We're not going out. And so he pulled out his .45, and it was loaded. If he'd been able to fire it, it would have done a number on somebody. Anyhow, there was a guy standing next to him that grabbed it in a way. When he pulled the trigger, the firing pin struck the web of his, he deliberately grabbed it in that fashion so that it couldn't strike the firing pin. That would have made quite a mess if the press had gotten a hold of that little detail.
Yeah.
You can imagine shooting up a bunch of guards down there in Hagerstown.
Oops.
How'd that happen?
And you said that while you're there and you're at the White House, you really wanted to be off fighting this war.
Yeah, I belonged overseas as far as I was concerned.
So what'd you do about that?
Well, I'd put in for flight training. I kept expecting to go flight training. And finally, one day, Mr. Krim came down and said, hey, Fergie, what's going to happen to you? Are you going to flight training? I said, I don't know. Nobody's talking to me. He said, do you mind if I check? And I said, no, go ahead. And he sat down on my phone and called the Commandant of the Marine Corps and said, what's going to happen? Well, of course, Commandant didn't know me from Adam. So I had orders to report to the colonel in charge of flight selection, had to report to him the following day, the morning. And so I went up to see him, and he really grumbled. He didn't like that order at all. But he'd been in Washington enough to know where his bread was buttered. He didn't know what kind of attachments that I had, who I knew or how close I was to him. So he was afraid to touch me, and he didn't have anything to hang his hat on. Everywhere I'd been, they gave me outstanding marks. And so he grumbled a bit, and I could see he was what we call a ring knocker. He was wearing an academy ring. What the trouble was, I had resigned from the Naval Academy Prep School, and he didn't like that. He thought that I was somebody inferior because I wouldn't go to the academy. So anyhow, he put me back on the flight list, and eventually I was called to flight training.
And the war's still going on. How exciting was that for you to actually get in the air and do some flying?
Well, it's what I'd wanted for ever since I was a young kid, to fly airplanes. So I was finally off and running.
And at that point, he couldn't even imagine where his aviation dreams might take him. We're going to get a taste of that when we come back, from dive bombers to the 1st Marine Corps helicopters. For photographs relating to Mr. Ferguson, his story, and his favorite museum, the Flying Leatherneck Aviation Museum in San Diego, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.